We have been studying books mostly written in Israel, right, over the time. But there are, how many books actually written outside of Israel in the Old Testament? Here's your thought question to start with on this session today. How many? Not two. Almost. How many books of the Old Testament? There's 39 books of the Old Testament. How many of them were written outside the land of Israel? Think of them. The two you're referring to are Daniel and Ezekiel. But there's also one other one called Esther. Okay, I put Esther in pink here in celebration of you ladies and also in celebration of the heroine of the story here who, Esther, you know, she acted like a man. Not really. She acted like a woman who was willing to be committed to the Lord, even to give her life if needed, to save her people. Not just to save herself, because the question that's going to happen in this book is, who's actually going to get destroyed in this extermination plot? It's not just all those other Jews. Once it's discovered that Esther is a Jew, her life was in danger as well. And thank God for women like her who are willing to be, you know, so committed to the Lord that their life is not that dear to them. So the whole plan is foiled, as we know, in the book of Esther. So I call the book Extermination Plot Foiled. This plot to kill all the Jews is stopped because of Esther. But is it only Esther? Our key word for the book is not Esther. Our key word for the book of Esther is providence. What we find in this book, which is one of two books in the Old Testament where the word God is not mentioned at all, is that God was very, very evident. What's the other book that doesn't mention God?
Song of Solomon.
Song of Solomon, yep. Book of Ruth is short as well, but it does mention several times they saying, the Lord bless you, and the Bethlehemites are saying that. And even Ruth, even Naomi mentions God, but she says, not in such a positive way in Ruth 1, God has made my life bitter, etc. But at least she mentions God. She doesn't try to deny God there. But here we see that even though God's not mentioned, and nothing spiritual is mentioned in this book, there's nothing about prayer. There's no mention of the Torah. There's no mention of any kind of religious activity. And it kind of raises the question, well, if there's no mention of any kind of anything spiritual, is the Lord still working? And of course, we know the answer to that question is very much so. And it's true in Song of Songs as well that doesn't mention God. Wasn't the Lord the one who just gave Solomon and his Shulamite wife this incredible love for one another? I mean, don't you feel that way in your marriage? I hope I could say marriage, not your courting, you know. Don't you feel that way about your husband or your wife, that God himself is the one who's made something of your life and of your marriage? And if you're not married, but the Lord has focused your feelings or your thoughts and all that toward someone, toward marriage, it's really God who gives us human love as well, even though his name's not mentioned. So I sum it up, this providence here. I don't use the word providence in the theme, but I have extermination plot foiled. It was man's plot to go against God's will, and man's plots against God's will cannot prevail, is what we find in the book of Esther. This is the idea that we see in the key verse of the book, chapter 4, verse 14. The whole book is kind of moving all up to, are all the Jews going to get destroyed or not? And Mordecai ends up with the one speaking for the Lord. Kind of, I don't know if you call this the climax of the book, but it all comes up to, well, what is Esther going to do? Is she going to risk her life to spare her people? And Mordecai says a very theologically astute statement without ever mentioning God in chapter 4, verse 14. If you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you've come to royal position for such a time as this. You notice that even in this verse, this key verse, God is not mentioned. He doesn't say anything about, oh, God is sovereign. God has put you in this place. He writes in kind of a passive voice here. He says, relief and deliverance will arise. He doesn't say actually who's going to do that relief and deliverance. But it leaves you and me as the readers to say, well, how is that going to happen? Wow. I mean, if the queen can't even save the people, well, if the queen can't save these people from the king, well, who's going to save them from the king? And this book is sort of like the book of Jonah, where it leaves you with just a lot of questions. You know, the book of Jonah ends with a question, where God says, you know, you didn't care about even this. You care about the plant, but you didn't care about Nineveh, 120,000 people don't know their right hand from their left. Shouldn't I care for such a people and for the animals as well? It's like, it kind of leaves you like, yeah, maybe if God cares, and if I care for a plant, if God cares for people, I care for a plant, maybe I should care for people. Kind of, Book of Esther does that. Over and over in it, it doesn't specifically give God credit, but it leaves you sort of saying, seriously? How did that happen? Was that coincidence? I hope you're one of those Christians who never uses the word coincidence. Or, they were really fortunate. Fortunate means fortune was going your way. You know what I mean? Well, that was just so happenstance. You know, we use so many of these words where we're sort of trying to devoiding God of any credit in it. And I'm not saying Esther's doing that. I'm saying Esther leaves you kind of hanging. It'd be like me saying, wow, that happened in your life. What a coincidence. And if I said it that way, hopefully you'd come back and you'd say, no, that wasn't a coincidence. That was God himself who put that person in that right place, had that person say that, who worked with these, you know, and you'd kind of come back. That's what this book is saying. So the kingdom idea here is God's providence in averting Israel's destruction showed his rule over all nations. The might and the power of the Persian Empire, no match for God. It was the superpower. But God providentially worked against this mightiest of nations in order to show that he's actually over all nations. I sum it up by saying an extermination of the Jewish nation plotted by Haman reverts upon his own head. By God's providence through Mordecai and Esther to encourage post-exilic Israel of God's continued commitment to the Abrahamic covenant. I think that's what actually Mordecai is referring to in Esther 4:14. Relief and deliverance for the Jews will come from some other place. I mean, we can't get killed. We can't get exterminated because God has promised that he will be with us. And we already saw in Jeremiah, God says in Jeremiah 31, this people, Israel, will always be a nation before me. So the covenant is very much here, even though the word covenant is not mentioned. God protected Israel from extinction the verses I just noted here. Fulfilling his covenant promise to bring Messiah mostly behind the scenes. Even what's happening in the palace is pretty much behind the scenes, except that you have a couple edicts that go all throughout the whole Persian Empire to protect the Jews. So redemption-wise, all efforts to destroy God's redemptive plan by annihilating his redemptive people Israel will fail, as did Haman's. And here's the redemption idea that we see actually through history. Is this the only extermination plot of the Jews that we find in history? Not at all. What other ones do we see in history? The Holocaust is the one that always comes to mind first because that's so foremost on the minds of the Jewish people. Can you think of others? If you're familiar with Jewish history, you'll know how people over the ages have tried to destroy the Jews. The Holocaust wasn't Muslim, but the Muslims have sought to destroy the Jews. The Romans sought to destroy the Jews twice. They conquered the entire country of Israel from AD 66 to 73. They destroyed the capital. Some remnants of Jews were allowed to stay, though. They were peaceful, law-abiding Jews. But that remnant grew over the next 70 years till AD 131, where a man named Bar Kokhba made another attempt against Rome. And at that point, this what's called the Bar Kokhba Rebellion was absolutely crushed by the Romans. Now, they wanted to destroy. They couldn't destroy all the Jews, but they certainly did all they could to destroy the homeland. They killed as many as they could, and they barred Jews from the land of Israel in AD 132. Imagine, barring Jews from Israel? That's like barring Chinese from China. That's like barring Vietnamese from Vietnam or whatever country, you know. They changed the name of Jerusalem to Aulia Capitolina, named after the capital. So they wouldn't even call Jerusalem Jerusalem anymore. And over the centuries, you see all these attacks against the Jewish people. They're satanic attacks. Satan is in many ways a picture of what Satan, Haman is in many ways a picture of what Satan has tried to do through the ages, all the way back to the Garden of Eden, to destroy God's plan by getting Adam and Eve to eat the fruit. And yet God says that Satan will be, he's the serpent whose head will get crushed, even though he bites at the heel. But anyway, it's an incredible study if you look into this and see how this actually works out. So Messiah is actually going to be protected. The queen's risk of death for the Jews and her role as an advocate portray these roles for Christ. She was willing to die. Jesus was willing to die. She was an advocate to the king. Jesus is called our advocate. I don't really ever hear people talk about Esther herself as a type of Christ, but there are some parallels here. So in our book chart here, we have extermination plot foiled. The plot is planned in the first four chapters. The plot is foiled in the last six chapters. The threat turns to triumph. And Haman himself is actually killed in the middle part of the book. But there's still a threat even after Haman dies. And there's this great deliverance that comes for the people. we get the Purim feast from this book, and so we see Huddleston's Acrostic Summarized Bible calls this Purim feast to summarize the 10 chapters of the book. I call it Be Committed. Since God has a providential plan that includes you and me, our response should be to be committed to Him. We should be people who say, wow, in light of the overall plan of God, I can really commit myself to this God, this unseen God in the book, this unnamed God in the book. And I dare say the Lord is working in your life and mine in far more ways than you observe or I observe. I think someday God's going to open our eyes to see how much He was actually working in our lives. And we're going to be amazed. And we're going to wish we had been more committed to His plans. The church typically has a serious lack of commitment. Why do you think, even in the church, people really aren't committed to the Lord? I want you to have opportunity to talk to the person next to you to answer that question. Let me give you a couple minutes to answer that question. Why do we lack commitment? All right? Talk to someone next to you to answer that question. Listening online, I would encourage you to answer the question yourself as well. Why do you think? Why is it that is a problem with God? I'm sure you would say, no, it's not. Is it a problem with you? If the problem's with you, what actually is the problem? What is the problem? Any more of these? Taking offerings. Cut your reading report. Thanks. Okay, did any of you sum it up? Sum it up pretty quickly. Great, thanks. Did any of you sum it up in terms of why you think there's a lack of commitment that you want to share with us? You're just enjoying talking to the person next to you, right? That's good. I'm glad you're doing that. That's good. I don't think they want to stop talking. Really, they would rather talk to other people than to listen to me? Imagine that. Any of you want to share? Did you hear something insightful? Of course, it wasn't what you said, but was the person next to you who had this good insight, right? I don't have the right answer on this, by the way. I'm not looking for the right answer because I don't know what it is. Yeah, Sue Ann?
I think it's, the big answer is sin, of course. But I think that part of it is also
sin, okay.
The way we are conditioned from the time we're born to value self-sufficiency, independence. And as a result, a lot of people grow up thinking that, they just go it alone.
So it's the sin of self-sufficiency that makes us lack commitment to the group, to the court, to the church, to the Lord.
Obeying God,
yeah.
Because you think you don't need Him, and well, the conditioning is such that when you need somebody, you would be more committed. So
So we think we don't need the Lord. And guess what? When we think we don't need the Lord, we're using the brain that the Lord gave us to think that thought. When we speak and we say, I don't need the Lord, we're using it. We're using the lips and the vocal cords and the mouth that God Himself gave us to say, I don't need you. That's not that way with other people. I mean, I can live life without you, for example. I can say that to you. I can live my life without you. If the class didn't show up, my life would still go on. But I wouldn't say that. I can't really say that about God. If God doesn't show up, then I don't even have breath for the next intake of oxygen that I need in my body, you know? Yeah. So that's great, self-sufficiency. Good. Other thoughts? The sin of self-sufficiency or independence. I'm assuming that there's one right answer, well, I'm not, all right? I just want you to think about this. And if you put yourself in the place of these Jews spread throughout the Persian Empire, really, I mean, are they really entrusting themselves to the Lord? I can't say, obviously, that I know what's happening with each one of them. Any more than right now, but there certainly is this. The issue isn't so much, we don't find so much in this book what all those Jews spread throughout the Persian Empire thought of God. We find more in this book what God thinks of those that are spread throughout the Persian Empire. This book, the focus of this book is really not the person of Esther. As in every other book of Scripture, the focus is God. This is a book about God. It's a book about how Esther fit into the purposes of God. And the question here, does God care about those left behind, is a relevant one, because most of the Jews never returned to the land of Israel even in the post-exilic period. We have to remember that we're picking up the account 483 BC. You know, it's like 50, 70 years after the people have come back to the land, two generations later, and you could get the impression, well, God was certainly with Ezra. I mean, I'm in the book of Ezra. God was certainly with Zerubbabel, Haggai, Malachi, that He had brought back to the land. But what about those who didn't actually go back? Let me see if I can review that. That chronology for you, because it's the big picture where we kind of fit in here. I'm going to go to slide 72 on this. We see that Zerubbabel, Haggai, Zechariah, they had all lived 539 to 516 during this 20 or 21 year period, 23 year period here, where the temple was being rebuilt. And the Lord had certainly gone back with them. 50,000 people came back to the land after this period of exile. But now in the book of Esther, we're picking up the account 516 to 483, what is that, 30 years? About 30 years later, what about all those people who still remained in Babylon, in Susa, in all the other towns where they had been spread? Not only the people of the southern kingdom, but the people of the northern kingdom. The question that arises is God still caring about them? We'll pick up with Ezra and Nehemiah in the last couple sessions and see how Malachi fits in there. But Esther kind of fits in the middle section, you might say, of the post-exilic era. Post-exilic era has this early section where the temple's rebuilt. It has this middle section where God provides protection for the people throughout the empire. And then it has the last section where the walls and the people are truly rebuilt under Ezra and Nehemiah. So we see this succession of kings of Persia, from Cyrus, who allows the people to go back, from Darius, who's the king at the time the temple gets finished, Xerxes, who ends up becoming the husband of Esther, and finally Artaxerxes of the post-exilic era, at the end of the post-exilic era. So we have a succession of four of these Persian kings that are all mentioned in Scripture as well. And so this question, does God care about those left behind? Hopefully it's answered very, very clearly to you that she's there in Susa, Esther is, in the capital, but this Persian empire stretched all the way over to Libya, all the way over to Greece in the far west, and then over to India, approaching China in the east. This is a vast, vast empire. And Jews spread throughout this empire. 127 provinces are mentioned in the very first verse of Esther. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes, who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush, India to Ethiopia. It's an amazing book. And we have the restoration of the temple and the people happening at this time. The book of Esther fits during this 58-year gap between Ezra 6 and Ezra 7. Because as we studied Ezra, we saw that Ezra is writing about his own time in the end of the book, chapter 7 to 10. So we have to distinguish the person Ezra from the author, or from the book Ezra. The book Ezra is talking about what had happened 100 years earlier when it begins. All right? And then, so Esther, we've got the queen, Esther. Get it? Stirring the S? Ha ha ha. This is Esther, the pretty Esther. And she does more than just stir her drink, right? What we find is that this book is telling us why we should be committed to God. If you get to the end of this book and you don't end up more committed to the Lord by reading this book, you've misread it. You haven't gotten the big picture of this book. Why? The book gives us two answers. Number one, it tells us that God's work faces threats. Why should we be committed to God? Because Satan is fighting against us at every point. We better be committed to God. He's always trying to push down whatever the Lord lifts up. And God commands us to have a wholehearted devotion to Him, because there are actually so many obstacles facing us. We see obstacle after obstacle after obstacle in these first four chapters. I mean, it looks absolutely hopeless when you get to the end of chapter 4. Haman has the upper hand. Haman is, in our words, a millionaire. I mean, he promises to put 50,000 pieces of silver in the treasury to kill all the Jews. He's on the king's good list, you know. The king thinks very highly of him. So he has power, he has money, he has hatred. Everything seems to be going against God's people here, facing these threats. And that's the focal point of the first half of the book. But we should also be committed to God, because God's work will triumph. And by aligning ourselves with the Lord and being committed to what He's doing, we can be assured that we will actually see the victory. You may not actually see it in your lifetime, because you may actually die before you see those the fruit of your labor. Many, many Christians have died before seeing the triumph of their work for the Lord. But that doesn't mean they haven't triumphed. Many Christians, as we know, more Christians have been martyred in the past century than the first 19 centuries combined. But it's a wonderful thing when you get to Revelation chapter 6, these are martyrs and they're seen as victors under the altar, actually, in heaven, portrayed as an altar. Like, people aren't supposed to be under altars. Altars are where animals are sacrificed, but many times people are in such a situation. I think the main idea of the book of Esther is this: despite Satan's threats, God will triumph. And you can see many other books like Esther written throughout the ages about how there have been these attempts to destroy the Jewish people, and the Lord has given triumph every time. Now, that's not to say there are huge people today. We have only about 16 million Jews. But think of the influence that 16 million Jews have on the world today. It's astounding. There's no other minority group in the world that's that small that has won, what, half of the Nobel Peace Prizes? The Jews don't even represent a half of 1% of the world's population. It seems pretty evident to me that God's hand is upon the Jewish people and He's protecting the Jewish people. And that's a good picture, really, of what God's doing with you as well. I mean, despite all of the opposition to the church around the world, it's God's work continues going on. We had one of our former students over for lunch two weeks ago from Nepal, and I don't know if you've heard about what's happening in Nepal, but in 2015 there was the Nepal earthquake. All right, April of 2015, absolutely devastated the capital area, especially the older buildings, and they couldn't even get on up into the remote areas. And so my pastor friend, I mean, and other pastors that I know that have trained when I've been in Nepal, they just got supplies, put them in their backpacks, and hiked with their youth up into these areas because cars could not get up there, motorcycles could not get up there. Nepal had one helicopter. They had one helicopter to help all of these areas. It was absolutely devastating. But the Christians reached out. And do you know, in the year 2015, what country in the world, out of the 220 countries of the world, what country had the highest rate of growth in 2015? Where the church grew more than any other place was Nepal. I mean, humanly speaking, you wouldn't put those two together, would you? Oh, wait a second. This place was devastated. And yet they had the highest rate of growth. It was like 12%, I think, rate of conversion in Nepal, more than any other country in the world. That's how God works. So I asked him, I said, well, how are you guys doing now? It's 3 years after the 2015. He said, the rate of growth is really high, but there's one other country that surpasses Nepal. It's called China. It's called China. And if you're up to date on what's happening with China, it's heartbreaking. I mean, on one hand, it's heartbreaking to see so many people imprisoned, churches just bulldozed down, blown up, you know, all government approved. And despite Satan's threats, God will triumph. It makes me wonder, you know, how much more we would grow if there was a greater persecution. I don't pray for persecution. I don't pray for persecution for any people, myself or others. But I just know that God is working in all these things. So what to do? Well, in some sense, you are placed in a position like Esther. You say, well, I'm not queen. No, you're not. But God has providentially placed you in a position to help someone. So here's the question. Will you be committed? Will you be committed to what the Lord has for you? There's the message of the book of Esther for you and for me. You have places of opportunity that I don't have. I have places of providentially designed opportunity that you don't have. And we both need to be committed to what God has put in our path. I think in a nutshell, that's really what the book of Esther is telling us. God's going to get his plan done, but he's going to use people. And frankly, if you don't play the role that God wants you to play, well, he may just steal the blessing from you and let someone else have the blessing of being involved. Had Esther not been faithful to the Lord, then God still would have protected his people. It's not like she had the whole weight of the whole existence of Israel on her shoulders. It was really on God's shoulders. No one person could handle that kind of a weight. And yet God does use people in regard to his, you know, his will there. So that's the basics of what we've got happening here. Now, do you have any questions? We have a few minutes left. Do you have any questions about the book of Esther? You've all read it. You've all prepared for today. And just looking at you, I can tell you guys are tired. You guys look tired. You know, it looks, just looking out at the class today, it looks like it's the last day of class. Hey, it's the last day of class. You look like it. I hope I don't look like it, but I probably look like it too. Yes, Randy.
Historically, is that showing that this actually happened? Like, there's a Queen Esther.
Okay, is there historical evidence for this? Well, I'm glad you asked, because what it does is it gives me an opportunity to show something that I haven't really shown before. We know Xerxes reigned from 486 to 464. Okay, that's all verified. I'm on slide 33 here. During the time of Xerxes, you can see on the right-hand side, the Persians defeat the Greeks at Thermopylae, but then they were reversed at Salamis. So says Herodotus. Okay, Herodotus was the Greek historian who talked about the Persian invasions. This was at the pinnacle of Greek history. I would really encourage you to go to Athens sometime. The Lord opens up a door for you to do that. My wife and I, just during one of the semester breaks, we just flew to Athens and were able to see the Acropolis. This is the pinnacle of Greek life, with the Parthenon at the top. And this was at its height at the time of when Xerxes was the ruler of Persia. And in that way, it was a target for Persia. The Greek people around 500 BC, 480, around that time, they had so much money because of gold mines, and there weren't that many people, I should say the Greek, they were city-states at this time, but the people of Athens had so much money, the average Athenian had enough money for 17 lifetimes. So enough money to live my life, and then I don't have to earn money, and, you know, let's suppose reincarnation was true, come back 16 times, never earn any money, you could live 17 lifetimes. That was the average. This place was so wealthy, so much gold. Well, you could see why they would be a real target for Persia. Xerxes said, let's conquer the Greeks. And the Greeks were all these various city-states. They hadn't been really organized. But that was the height of Greek civilization at this time. The pinnacle had Athena, the goddess of wisdom. This is not what it actually looks like, but this is an enactment or a replica of it. And they considered her to be their patron. So the Persians invaded them in various waves from 500 to 479. So yet we see in history that Xerxes was going and attacking the Greeks. You'll see that the Persian Empire on this map comprised all this orange area all the way up to Macedonia. And he wanted it all. Some people are really like that. And so they had a battle at Marathon, where the Greeks couldn't even hope to face the superior Persian cavalry. But the location they chose here enabled them to, the Persians actually, to be able to defeat them. And we get our word Marathon here because of the city of Marathon and a runner who ran to the 26 miles, actually, to bring the message. But Greece was actually defeated by the Persians here. And so we end up seeing them defeated in 490 at the time when Darius was the king. Now some 20 years later, or actually just 4 years later, Darius ends up turning the rule over to Xerxes. So we see Xerxes with this 7-day banquet where Queen Vashti was deposed in 483. Right. Now how does that fit in? That's 7 years later. Well, the Greeks were defeated in 490. Book of Esther comes about 483. And we see the Persians end up defeating at the Greeks at Thermopylae later on. But you have to realize that the Greeks Greeks had already defeated the Persians up here. So Xerxes was basically the defeated foe here. And you could see one of the reasons why he might be so angry at his wife. That's what happens to a lot of us husbands, you know? You're angry at something else, and then you take it out on your wife, you know? Sorry if that's the way it works, but... But anyway, so... These various battles, I'm losing the ladies here in the class because you're not really interested in all these battles, but the Greeks had very fast and deadly ships. Here's the big idea, okay? And so the Greeks ended up really devastating the Persians in 480. Yeah. Anyway, at the Battle of Salamis. The Greeks lost 40 ships. The Persians lost between 200 and 300 ships. So the victory, the Greek victory at Salamis ended Xerxes' invasion, and it preserved Greek freedom. So that's kind of how it fits in relationship to the Book of Esther. So coming back victory and then lost victory and then lost. We see Esther becoming queen after a 4-year beauty contest around December 480, maybe January 479. And as I have here at the top, Persian invasions of Greece led to a frustrated Xerxes. You know, he wanted all that wealth, he wanted all that power, he wanted all that acclaim, but he ended up getting defeated. And then he has to go back home with hundreds of his ships destroyed, and he was quite a frustrated man. So yes, you can fit the Book of Esther into this in terms of the chronology here. it fits in terms of him being away for a while and being back in. And I have page 314 will give you the various key dates related to the book of Esther. All right, there are several unique things about the book. One of them is that, let me see some other things. One of them is that several people over the years didn't want to put Esther into the Bible. There were some rabbis that were fighting against Esther, and actually five books of the Old Testament. Do you remember what some of the other ones are? Song of Songs, because it's too sexual, too erotic. Esther, because God's not mentioned. Some people thought Proverbs, well, that shouldn't be in the Bible, because one proverb says, it's like Proverbs 26, I think, it says, don't answer a fool according to his folly. And the next proverb says, answer a fool according to his folly. In certain cases, you should answer a fool. In certain cases, you shouldn't answer a fool. But some people said, well, that's contradictory, and that proverb shouldn't be in the Bible, you know. And then they had a hard time with Ezekiel. That temple in Ezekiel didn't fit Solomon's temple. And they weren't able to think outside the box and realize God can change all the topography and have an entirely new Jerusalem big enough to fit Ezekiel's temple. And so, anyway, Esther is one of these. Did I give you all five of them? Yeah. The e-books. The three of them are e-books. Esther, Ezekiel, and Ecclesiastes also. E-E-E. Think of triple E. That'll give you three of the five books of the Old Testament that people over the centuries have said, hey, these really shouldn't be in the Bible. That's what I call reading the book, but not really reading the book. Reading the words, but not really catching the idea of the book. The book, like here's Esther, you know? I'm on, those of you following on slide 78. Our key word for Esther is providence. Yes, God's name is not mentioned, but he's all over the whole thing. You know, and that's what we put in terms of the key verse of the book. It's been a book that's been painted many, many times. There's lots of, you'll see as you go on through. There's, and many movies have been made of the book of Esther, you know. And they even use FaceTime, you know, to put other, I mean, no, not FaceTime, Photoshop to do this. So here's the idea. An extermination plot, extermination of the Jewish nation plotted by Haman reverts upon his own head through God's providence, through Mordecai and Esther, to encourage post-exilic Israel of God's continued commitment to the Abrahamic covenant. And I haven't gone through the various, each one of the movements of the book, except for the big ones here about the how the plot was planned. But there's a lot of details in the book that are, it's not just circumstantial evidence. This is God working behind the scenes. He has Mordecai in exactly the right place to overhear these two guys plotting the death of the king. He has, he gives the king insomnia the very night where he's planning to exalt Haman, and he decides, you know, he can't sleep, so the way to resolve it is read to me the rain, my rain, and that'll put me to sleep. It'd be like me saying, sweetheart, I can't sleep. Read to me all the things I've done in my years here at Singapore Bible College. That'll put me to sleep, you know? And then it doesn't work. It doesn't work. In fact, it's evidently later on in the morning, and he says, you're reading to me about Mordecai? Mordecai saved my life? Well, what have we done to honor him and thank him? Oh, nothing's been done for him, king. You know, like all this is sort of just circumstantial. Are you kidding? He doesn't even say, read me the account of when Mordecai saved my life. He just says, open up the record of my reign and read to me. That'll put me to sleep, you know? Maybe he's saying, please don't read about the loss at Salamis or some of those other battles. Please don't read that part. But, you know, he says, just read it to me. And God knows exactly where to read, you know. the Lord is doing it all along in his life, and he's doing it in our life. So I hope you caught the reasons why we should be committed to God. God's work faces threats, and then God's work ultimately will triumph. Those are our reasons. So, be committed.